The talk by Harvard biologist Richard Lewontin that you're about to hear was the first of a series of lectures he gave at the University of Toronto in 1990 on the theme Biology as Ideology. It could have been given yesterday, it's so relevant. Richard Lewontin is the Alexander Agassiz Professor of Zoology at Harvard and is renowned in his field for his studies of population genetics. He's authored many books, both popular and technical, on evolutionary biology and genetics, as well as the philosophy of science. He's been an outspoken critic and activist against militarism and class privilege since the 1960s, and as an advocate of making science answerable to the majority of the people rather than in the service of an elite.
I want to talk tonight, and in the four lectures that follow this one, about a social institution about which there's a great deal of misunderstanding, even among those who are part of it. That institution is science. Most of what I want to say will be specifically about biology, but biology is only a model of how science works in general. We think of science as an institution, as a set of methods, a set of people, a great body of knowledge that we call scientific knowledge. And we see it as somehow being pretty much apart from the forces that rule our everyday lives and that govern the structure of our society. Science is objective. And of course, science has brought us all kinds of good things. It has tremendously increased the production of food. It's increased our life expectancy from a mere 45 years at the beginning of the century to over 70 in rich countries like ours. It's put people on the moon, and it's made it possible to sit at home and watch the world go by. Of course, it's produced some horrors, too, like the nuclear bomb and pesticides that pollute our environment. But we believe that science just uncovers the facts, and it's society that either uses or misuses them for good or evil. What I want to say about science in these lectures is quite different. I want to try to convince you that science, like any other productive activity, like the state, like the family, like sport, is a social institution, and as such, it's completely integrated into and influenced by the rest of our social institutions. The problems that science deals with, the ideas that it uses in investigating those problems, even the so-called scientific results that come out of scientific investigation, are really all deeply influenced by predispositions that derive from the society in which we live. Scientists do not begin life, after all, as scientists. They begin as social beings, like everyone else, immersed in a family, a state, a productive structure, and they view nature through a lens that's been molded by their social experience. What else could they do? But even above that personal level of perception, science is molded by society because it's a human productive activity. It takes time, it takes money. Science uses commodities, and it produces commodities that are sold in the marketplace. People earn their living by it. I earn my living by it. And as a consequence, the dominant social and economic forces in society that control time and money determine to a large extent what science does and how it does it. But more than that, those people with access to power are able to appropriate from science ideas that are particularly suited to the maintenance and continued prosperity of existing social structures. I'm going to give many examples in my talks, but let me begin with one that's particularly prominent at the present. For some years now, women have been pressing a society dominated by men to give up that domination and to open all the avenues of power and control of their own lives to women. In an effort to legitimize the differential power of men in society, educational institutions controlled by men, like the one in which I work, and newspapers, magazines, radio, and TV that regularly report and popularize the claims of intellectuals, have been producing all sorts of claims for the biological inferiority of women. It's instructive to see how one scientific claim follows another, as different aspects of women's biology are said to be important. Sometimes it's claimed that women's bodies are simply too slight to carry out the heavy physical work of being, say, an electrician or a firefighter. Then it's said that women's hormones make them unreliable on a monthly basis. You wouldn't want a menstruating woman flying an airplane, would you? Most recently, we've heard that the structure of women's brains make them worse at mathematics and other serious cognitive work, although they're fine at intuition, because they use the left halves of their brains, whereas men use the right cognitive halves. Finally, we've been told that women use both halves of their brains more than men do, so that women can't think about specialized things. Of course, all of these differences are said to be coded in our genes. So women do not have the genes for math, the genes for business, the genes for aggressiveness, the genes for all those things that are supposed to give power in society. Women are doomed by their genes to an inferior position, and no matter how well-intentioned we may be, we just have to face facts. Anatomy is destiny. So social institutions have an input into science, both in what's done and how it's thought about, and they take from science concepts and ideas which then support those institutions and make them seem legitimate and natural. It's this dual process that is meant when I say science is an ideology. Look, science serves two functions. First, it provides us with new ways of manipulating the material world. It produces a set of techniques, practices, inventions, by which new things are produced and by which the quality of our lives is changed. These are the aspects of science to which scientists appeal when they try to get money from governments, or when they appear on the front pages of newspapers in their public relations pressures to support their continued prosperity. We read repeatedly about how science has discovered something. But more often than not, these announcements are hedged around with all sorts of qualifiers. Biologists discover evidence for genes that may one day lead to a possible cure for cancer. While their over-optimistic reports breed a certain cynicism, it's nevertheless true that scientists do actually change the way in which we confront the material world. The second function of science, which is sometimes independent and sometimes closely related to the first, is the function of explanation. Even if scientists are not actually changing the material mode of our existence, they're constantly explaining why things are the way they are. They're producing theories about the world. It's often said that those theories must be produced in order, ultimately, to change the world through practice. After all, how can we cure cancer unless we understand what causes cancer? How can we increase our food production unless we understand the laws of genetics and plant and animal nutrition? Yet it's remarkable how much really important practical science has been quite independent of theory. In a later talk, I'm going to consider one of the most famous examples of scientific agricultural change, the introduction of hybrid corn all over the world. Hybrid corn is claimed to be one of the great triumphs of modern genetics in action, in helping to feed people and increase their well-being. Yet, as a matter of fact, the development of hybrid corn, and indeed almost all of plant and animal breeding, as it's actually practiced, has been carried out in a way that's completely independent of any scientific theory about how it ought to work. Indeed, a great deal of plant and animal breeding has been done in a way indistinguishable from the methods of past centuries before anyone had ever heard of genetics. The same is true for our attempts to cope with killers, like cancer and heart disease. Most cures for cancer are either the surgical removal of the growing tumor or its destruction with powerful radiations or chemicals. Virtually none of this progress in cancer therapy has occurred through a deep understanding of the elementary processes of cell growth and development, although nearly all of the cancer research, above the purely clinical level, is devoted precisely to that understanding. So, despite all the talk of scientific medicine, medicine remains essentially an empirical process in which people do what works. If we look at the actual accomplishments of science, it's not at all clear that a correct understanding of how the world works is basic to many successful manipulations of the world. But explanations of how the world really works serve another purpose, one in which has been a remarkable success, irrespective of the practical truth of scientific claims. That purpose is legitimating society as we know it. Irrespective of what your political view may be, everyone has to agree that we live in a world in which psychic and material welfare is very unevenly distributed. There are rich people and poor people. There are sick people and healthy people. People who have control over the conditions of their own lives, like professors who give lectures on the radio, and those who have their tasks assigned to them, who are overseen, who have little or no control over any psychic or material aspects of their own lives, like the janitor who's going to come in and sweep up the studio when we're finished here. There are rich countries and poor countries. Some races dominate others. Men and women have very unequal social and material power. Some kind of inequality of status, wealth, health, and power have been characteristic of every society about which we know. That means that in every society about which we know, there's some form of struggle going on between those who have and those who have not, between those with social power and those who are deprived of it. The uprisings of blacks in American cities in the 1960s and 1970s, in which there was a vast destruction of property and what you might call a radical redistribution of consumer goods, and the armed struggle of Mohawk Indians in Canada to prevent the encroachment of commercial and state power on their lands, are only the most recent examples of a long history of violent confrontations between those with status, wealth, and power, and those without it. Repeated peasant uprisings in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries resulted in the wholesale destruction of crops and buildings and the loss of hundreds of thousands of lives. The deeds of peasant rebels like Pugachev and Zdenka Razin in Eastern Europe live in song and story. It's obviously in the interest of those who have power in society to prevent such violent and destructive conflicts, even if, with the police power of the state, they're sure eventually to win. Repeatedly, as such struggles go on, there are created institutions whose function it is to forestall violent struggle by convincing people that the society in which they live is just and fair, or if it's not just and fair, that it's inevitable and it's quite useless to resort to violence. These are what we call institutions of social legitimation. They're just as much a part of the social struggle as the hayrick burnings and machine destructions of the Captain Swing riots in Britain in the 19th century that helped to populate Australia with their penal colonies. But they use very different weapons. They use ideological weapons. The battleground is now in people's heads, and if the battle is won on that ground, then the peace and tranquility of society are guaranteed. For almost the entire history of European society, since the Empire of Charlemagne, the chief institution of social legitimation was the Christian Church. It was by the grace of God that each person had his or her appointed place in society. Kings ruled Dei gratia. Of course, occasionally divine grace could be conferred on a commoner who was ennobled, and grace could be removed. Grace was removed from King Charles I, as Cromwell noted, and the proof was Charles' severed head. Even the most revolutionary of religious leaders pressed the claims of legitimacy for the sake of order. Martin Luther, that great religious revolutionary, enjoined his flock to obey their lords. And in his famous sermon on marriage, he asserted that justice was made for the sake of peace and not peace for the sake of justice. Peace is the ultimate social good, and justice is important only if it subserves peace. So, women, obey your husbands. Now, for an institution to serve the function of explaining the world so as to make it legitimate, that institution has to possess several features. First, the institution as a whole must appear to derive from sources outside of ordinary human struggle. It must not seem to be the creation of political, economic, or social forces, but it has to descend into society from some superhuman source. Second, the ideas, the pronouncements, the rules, the results of that institution's activity must have a validity and a transcendent truth that goes beyond any possibility of human compromise or human error. Its explanations and pronouncements must seem to be true in an absolute sense, and to derive somehow from some absolute source. They must be true for all time and all place. And finally, the institution must have a certain mystical and veiled quality, so that its innermost operation is not completely transparent to everyone, to the man on the street. It must have an esoteric language which needs to be explained to the ordinary person by those who are especially knowledgeable and who can intervene between everyday life and the mysterious sources of understanding and knowledge. Obviously, the Christian Church, or indeed any revealed religion, fits these requirements perfectly. And so religion has been an ideal institution for legitimating society. But you know, this description also fits science and has made it possible for science to replace religion as the chief legitimating force in modern society. After all, science claims a method that's objective and non-political. It's true for all time. Scientists truly believe that except for the unwanted intrusions of ignorant politicians, science is above the social fray. My teacher, a famous scientist who was a refugee from the Bolshevik Revolution and who detested the Bolsheviks, devoted a lot of energy to pointing out the serious scientific errors that were being made in the Soviet Union in biology and in genetics as a consequence of the unorthodox biological doctrines of T.D. Lysenko. I once pointed out to him that following his own political convictions, he ought not to carry on that campaign against Lysenko. After all, he believed that sooner or later a global conflict would occur with the United States and the Soviet Union on opposite sides. And he also believed that Lysenko's false scientific doctrines were severely weakening Soviet agricultural production. So why did he not then simply remain quiet about Lysenko's errors, so that the Soviet Union would be weakened and compromised in the conflict that was to come? His answer was that his obligation to speak the truth about science was superior to all other obligations, and that a scientist must never allow a political consideration to prevent him from saying what he believes to be true. Not only the methods and institutions of science are said to be above ordinary human relations, but of course the product of science is claimed to be a kind of universal truth. The secrets of nature are unlocked. Once the truth about nature is revealed, then no one can fight it. One must accept the facts of life. When science speaks, let no dog bark. Finally, science speaks in mysterious words. No one except an expert can understand what scientists say and do, and we require the mediation of special people, science journalists, for example, or professors who speak on the radio, to explain the mysteries of science, because otherwise there's nothing but indecipherable formulas. Nor can one scientist understand the formulas of another scientist. Once, when Sir Sally Zuckerman, the famous English zoologist, was asked what he does when he reads a scientific paper and comes across a mathematical formula, he said, "Oh, I hum them." Of course, despite its claims to be above society, science, like the church before it, is a supremely social institution, reflecting the dominant values and views of society at each historical epoch, as well as reinforcing them. Sometimes, the ways in which scientific theories are translated directly from social experience are obvious, even at a detailed level. The most famous case is Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. No scientist doubts that the organisms on Earth today have evolved over billions of years from organisms that were very unlike them, and that nearly all types of organisms have long since gone extinct. Moreover, we know this to be a natural process, resulting from the differential survivorship of different forms. In this sense, we all accept Darwinism as being true. But Darwin's explanation for that evolution is a very different matter. He claimed that there was a universal struggle for existence, because more organisms were born than could survive, and that in the course of that struggle for existence, those organisms that were more efficient, better designed, cleverer, and generally better built for the struggle would leave more offspring than the inferior kinds. As a consequence of this victory in the struggle for existence, evolutionary change occurred. But even Darwin himself was conscious of the source of his own ideas about the struggle for existence. He claimed that the idea for evolution by natural selection occurred to him after reading the famous Essay on Population by the Reverend Malthus, a late 18th century economist. That essay was an argument against the old English poor law, which provided welfare payments for the poor in their own homes. The landowners, for whom Malthus was a spokesman, wanted a much tougher law, in which the poor would receive minimal relief and only if they worked at hard labor in parish workhouses. Malthus supported this argument by claiming that all organisms, including human beings, reproduce too rapidly for the growth of their resources. Thus, if the poor were supported too liberally, they would simply reproduce more poor people, who would be a further drain on resources. The only solution was to let starvation take its inevitable and natural toll. Darwin saw in Malthus a universal principle, that all organisms are engaged in the struggle for existence in a world of insufficient resources. Therefore, only those who are more efficient and skillful would survive. By the competition between individuals, acting in their own narrow self-interest, all of evolutionary progress had taken place. This is precisely what Adam Smith argued when he claimed that individual economic competition would act as an invisible hand to make the economy as a whole act efficiently. In this way, Darwin's whole theory of evolution by natural selection bears an uncanny resemblance to the political economic theory of early capitalism. Darwin himself had some personal knowledge of the economic survival of the fittest because he got his living from investment in railroad shares, which he followed daily in the newspapers. What Darwin did was to take early 19th century political economy and expand it to include all of natural economy. Moreover, he developed a theory of sexual selection and evolution, in which the chief force is the competition among males to be more appealing to discriminating females. This theory is meant to explain why male animals often display bright colors or complex mating dances. It's not clear that Darwin was conscious of how similar his view of sexual selection was to the standard 19th century Victorian view of the proper relationship between middle-class males and middle-class females. In reading Darwin's theory, one can see the proper young lady seated on her sofa while the swain on his knees before her begs for her hand, having already told her father how many hundreds a year he has in income. Most of the ideological influence from society that permeates science is a great deal more subtle than this. It comes in the form of basic assumptions, of which scientists themselves are usually not aware. Yet those assumptions have a profound effect on the forms of their explanations, and in turn serve to reinforce social attitudes that gave rise to those explanations in the first place. One important example is the way scientists have interpreted the relation of individuals to collectivities, the famous problem of parts and wholes. Before the 18th century, European society placed little or no emphasis on the importance of the individual. On the contrary, the activity of people was determined by the social class into which they were born, except in very exceptional cases, and individual people confronted each other as representatives of their social groups. In a dispute, for example, between a priest and a merchant over some commercial matter, the priest would make his case in an ecclesiastical court before his bishop, and the merchant in the court of his own lord, rather than both being subject to the same uniform judgment. Individuals were not seen as the causes of social arrangements, but as their consequence. Moreover, people were not free to move in the economic hierarchy. Peasants and lords alike had mutual obligations and were bound to each other by those obligations. There were no freely moving competitive labor forces where each person had the power to sell his or her own labor power in the labor market. Those relations made it quite impossible to develop the kind of productive capitalism that marks our own era, in which freedom for individuals to move from place to place, from task to task, from status to status, to confront each other sometimes as buyers and sometimes as sellers, sometimes as owners and sometimes as tenants, sometimes as producers and sometimes as consumers, is an absolute necessity. For example, serfdom had to be abolished in Russia in the middle of the 19th century because there was a shortage of factory labor, and serfs were prohibited by law from being sent to factories. Sometimes, in fact, serf owners illegally shipped their peasants into factories, and we know that serfs petitioned the Tsar for relief. Just as social organization was seen as an indissoluble whole, so was nature. Living and dead could be transformed one into the other, provided one knew the mystical formula. Nature could not be understood by taking it into pieces, because by doing so, one destroyed what was essential to it. Alexander Pope said, "It was like following life through creatures you dissect. You lose it in the moment you detect." One consequence was that human anatomy and the functions of various organs could not be understood, because one could not dissect them, nor could one look at each organ separately as having a separate function. Another was that herbs and roots were regarded as treatments for various parts of the body if their shape was similar to those parts. So, for example, mandrake root, which looked like a little baby or a small human, was supposed to be good for infertility. With the change in social organization that was brought about by developing industrial capitalism, a whole new view of society arose, one in which the individual was primary and independent, a kind of autonomous social atom that could move from place to place and role to role. Society is now thought to be the consequence not the cause of individual properties. It's individuals who together make society. Modern economics is grounded in the theory of consumer preference. Individual autonomous firms compete with each other and replace each other. Individuals have power over their own bodies and their own labor power in what we call possessive individualism. This atomized society is matched by a new view of nature, the reductionist view. Now it is believed that the whole is to be understood only by taking it into pieces, that the individual bits and pieces, the atoms, molecules, cells, genes, are the causes of the properties of the whole objects and must be separately studied if we are to understand complex nature. Darwin's theory of evolution was a theory of the differential reproductive rate of individuals. Those individuals with certain traits, certain properties that made them more efficient, that made them use the resources of the limited world better, would leave more offspring. And the consequence would be that the species as a whole would evolve toward those more efficient and those better forms. All of the phenomena of evolution could be understood at this individual causal level. All of modern biology, and indeed all of modern science, takes as its informing metaphor the clock mechanism described by René Descartes in part 5 of his Discours. Descartes, being religious, excluded the human soul from the universal clock, but that very soon came to be included as well. Modern science sees the world, both living and dead, as a large and complicated system of gears and levers. A second feature of the transformation of scientific views in the industrial era has been the clear separation between causes and effects. Things are supposed to be either one or the other. Again, in Darwin's view, organisms were acted upon by the environment. They were the passive objects, and the external world was the active subject. This alienation of the organism from its outside world means that the outside world has its own laws that are independent of the organisms, and so cannot be changed by those organisms. Organisms find the world as it is, and they must either adapt or die. Nature, love it or leave it. It's the natural analog of the old saw that you can't fight City Hall. As we'll see in a later lecture, this is an impoverished and incorrect view of the actual relationship between organisms and the world they occupy, a world which they by and large create by their own living activities. So, the ideology of modern science, and especially of modern biology, makes the properties of individuals the causal source of all the properties of larger collectivities. It prescribes a way of studying the world which is to cut it up into little bits and pieces, the bits and pieces that cause it, and to study the properties of those bits in isolation. It breaks the world up into independent, autonomous domains, the internal and the external. Causes are either internal or external, and there is no mutual dependency between them. For biology, this worldview has resulted in a particular picture of organisms and their total life activity. Living beings are seen as being determined by internal factors, the genes. Our genes and the DNA molecules that make them up are the modern form of the old religious doctrine of grace. Either you have it when you're born or you don't. There's nothing you can do in life to acquire it. You either are in a state of grace or you are not. In the same way, biologists claim that some of us are born with the genes that make us intelligent, that make us aggressive, that give us wonderful temperaments, that make us possible to be successful in life, and others are born with genes that destine us to be imposed on by others, to be poor, to be unhealthy. According to this view, we will only understand what we are when we know what our genes are made of. The world outside us poses certain problems which we do not create, but only experience as objects. The problems are to find a mate, to find food, to win out in competition over others, to acquire a large part of the world resources as our own. And if we have the right kinds of genes, we'll be able to solve those problems and we'll leave more offspring. So, according to this view, it's really our genes that are propagating themselves through us. We are only their instruments, their temporary vehicles, through which the genes that make us up either succeed or fail to spread through the world. In the words of Richard Dawkins, one of the leading proponents of this biological view, we are lumbering robots whose genes control us body and mind. Just as at one level, genes determine individuals, so at the next level, it's individuals that determine collectivities. If we want to understand, for example, why an ant colony has the particular division of tasks that it has, or a flock of birds flies in a particular way, we need only to look at the individual ants and the individual birds, because the behavior of the group is a consequence of the individual behaviors of the single organisms, which of course are in turn determined by their genes. For human beings, that view means that the structure of our society is seen as nothing but the result of the collection of individual behaviors. If our country goes to war, it's because we feel aggressive as individuals. If we live in a competitive, entrepreneurial society, it's because each one of us, as an individual, has a drive to be competitive and entrepreneurial. Genes make individuals, and individuals make society, and so genes make society. If one society is different from another, that's because the genes of the individuals in one society are different from the genes in another. Different races are thought to be genetically different in how aggressive or creative or musical they may be. Indeed, culture as a whole is seen as made up of little bits and pieces of cultural bric-a-brac, what some sociobiologists call culture gens. A culture is simply a sack of bits and pieces, like aesthetic preferences, mating preferences, work and leisure preferences. Dump out the sack, and culture will be displayed before you. So, the hierarchy is complete. Genes make individuals, individuals have particular preferences and behaviors, and the collection of preferences and behaviors makes a culture. And so, genes make a culture. That's why molecular biologists are urging us to spend as much money as necessary to get the sequence of all of the DNA that makes up the genes of a human being. Because they say, when we know the sequence of the molecules that make up all our genes, we will know what it is to be human. When we know what our DNA looks like, we will know why some of us are rich and some are poor, some are healthy and some are sick, some are powerful and some are weak. We'll also know why some societies are powerful and rich, and others are weak and poor. Why one nation, one sex, one race dominates another. Indeed, we'll know why there's such a thing as a science of biology, which is itself one of the bits and pieces of culture lying at the bottom of the sack. We've become so used to the atomistic machine view of the world that originated with Descartes that we have really forgotten that it's a metaphor. We no longer think as Descartes did, that the world is like a clock, we think it is a clock. We cannot imagine an alternative view, unless it be one that goes back in history to a pre-scientific era. For those who are dissatisfied, and properly so, with the modern world, and dislike the artifacts of science, the pollution, the noise, the industrial world, the wars, the over-mechanized medical care that seems not to make us feel better much of the time, for people who want to go back to nature in the good old ways, the response has been to return to a description of the world as an indissoluble whole which we murder to dissect. For them, there's no use in trying to break anything down into any parts because we lose the essence inevitably, and the best we can do is to treat the world holistically. But this so-called holistic worldview is not tenable. It's simply another form of mysticism, and it does not make it possible to manipulate the world for our own benefit. An obscurantist holism has been tried, and it's failed. Thinking good thoughts and visualizing one's tumor has not cured cancer. Eating macrobiotic diets has ruined people's health. It has not improved their nutrition. So-called holistic medicine, despite the anecdotal testimony of a few, has proved no more curative than prayer. The world is not one huge organism that regulates itself to some good end, as the believers in the Gaia hypothesis believe. There is not a shred of evidence for such a self-regulating system. 99.999% of all the species that have ever lived are already extinct, and the rate of extinction at the present is about what it was 1 billion years ago. In 3 billion years from now, the Earth will be burned to a cinder by an expanding sun, so life is half over. Universal balance and harmony are ideologies, pure and simple, invoked in an understandable revulsion against the soulless ideology of Adam Smith's invisible hand. While in some theoretical sense, the trembling of a flower is felt on the farthest star, in practice, my gardening really does not have an effect on the orbit of Neptune, because the forces of gravitation are extremely weak, and they fall off very rapidly with distance. So there's clearly truth in the belief that the world can be broken up into independent parts. But that is not a universal direction for how to study all of nature. A lot of nature, as we shall see, cannot be broken up into independent parts that are to be studied in isolation, and it is pure ideology to suppose that they can. The problem is to construct a third view, one that sees the entire world neither as an indissoluble whole, nor with the equally incorrect, but presently dominant view, that at every level the world is made up of bits and pieces that can be isolated and that have properties that can be studied in isolation. Both of these ideologies, one that mirrors the pre-modern feudal social world, and the other that mirrors the modern competitive individualistic entrepreneurial world, prevent us from seeing the full richness of interaction in nature. In the end, they prevent a real understanding of nature and prevent us from solving the problems to which science is supposed to apply itself. In the lectures that follow this one, I look in some detail at particular manifestations of the modern scientific ideology and the false paths down which it has led us. I'll consider how biological determinism has been used to explain and justify inequalities within and between societies, and to claim that those inequalities can never really be changed because they are fixed in our genes. We will see how a theory of human nature has been developed, using Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, to claim that social organization is also unchangeable because it has been fixed in our genes and because it is natural. We will see how problems of health and disease have been located within the individual and within the individual's genes, so that the individual becomes a problem for society to cope with, rather than society becoming a problem for the individual to cope with. And we will see how simple economic relations, masquerading as facts of nature, can drive the entire direction of biological research and technology. While these lectures are meant, frankly, to disillusion the listener about the objectivity and the vision of transcendent truth claimed by scientists, they're not intended to be anti-scientific or to suggest that we should give up science in favor of astrology or thinking beautiful thoughts. Rather, they're meant to acquaint the listener with the truth about science as a social activity and to promote a reasonable skepticism about the sweeping claims that modern science makes to an understanding of human existence. But there's an important difference between skepticism and cynicism. For the former, skepticism can lead to action, and the latter, cynicism, leads only to passivity. So these lectures have a political end, too, and that is to encourage the listeners not to leave science to the experts, not to be mystified by it, but to demand a sophisticated scientific understanding in which everyone can share.
The 1990 Massey Lectures, presented by Richard C. Lewontin, continue tomorrow night on Ideas. Following the Massey Lectures, I had an opportunity to interview Professor Lewontin about their content. I began by asking him what he thought biology had missed by focusing on a reductionist approach to research.
Well, there are two primary problems that biology at least has failed to solve because of its entirely reductionist and mechanist viewpoint, and that is the problem of the development of the organism from the fertilized egg and the problem of the development of what we call our nervous system, but in fact we mean our entire set of attitudes, thoughts, the problem of the central nervous system. Those two problems are related to each other. They're both developmental problems. One is a problem of the development of the physical organism in its simple physiological and anatomical aspects, and the other is the development of attitudes, views, the way we think, how we remember, how we recognize, that kind of function of our brains. Both of those problems remain almost, not quite, but almost in the same state they were 50 or 100 years ago. It's clear that the central nervous system cannot be understood, or at least has not been understood, by simple reductionist mechanical models like computers or single circuits or the firing of a particular electronic tube as they would be in an electronic circuit. And the same thing is true for development. There have been all sorts of reductionist fads in understanding how organisms develop from the fertilized egg.
And how would you like to see science progress?
I think we need to pay very much more attention to higher level structures rather than always thinking that all of the information is contained at the lowest level. I can give you an example from ecology and evolution, which has nothing to do with the actual structure of cells. There's a great deal of talk about how individual species can continue to exist, what keeps them from going extinct, what determines how many species there are. And the standard way of studying this has been to look at each species as an entity in its evolution. You ask, how did humans evolve? How did rats evolve? How did plants evolve? But there's practically no study, there's a little bit, but practically no study of how different species co-evolve. That is to say, how the evolution of the human species was influenced by the simultaneous evolution of other species around it. How the evolution of the human species was influenced by the evolution of the environment in which the organism lives. And the evolution of the environment in which the organism lives is a consequence of the evolution of the organism because organisms make their own environment. So we need to carry on what we can call co-evolutionary studies. We need to study the simultaneous evolution of organisms in their environment, the simultaneous evolution of different organisms that are interacting, like plants and their insect pests, like plants and the animals that feed on them, and so study the evolution of those higher-level structures. That's the story of coevolution of the organism and its environment. It is left out of account entirely in classical Darwinism, and classical Darwinism has then directed all of our attention to how organisms differ one from the other in a fixed world, whereas what we should be looking at is how different kinds of organisms make different worlds. And that's experimentally attackable. That's not simply a theoretical issue. I can go into my laboratory, into the field tomorrow, and by setting up particular kinds of external worlds, a particular amount of moisture and other organisms and temperature and food and so on, I can ask the question, how do genetically different organisms alter that world in different ways, and how does the alteration that they make in that external environment come back on them to affect their own future evolution? Those are experimentally attackable, but nobody does it.
We often see it, though, don't we? The Galapagos, for example, seem to have been shot down in places by goats. Goats are, I guess, desert animals originally, and they sure try to turn everything into a desert, don't they?
Well, I don't know if they try, but they certainly succeed. And we see every day around us, I mean, it's our everyday experience, that organisms are making the world for themselves. Squirrels bury nuts, birds make nests, people make houses. Every organism is in the process of reconstructing the world to suit its demands. And if different organisms have slightly different demands, they reconstruct the world in slightly different ways, and we need to know a great deal more about that.
You're implying that it's virtually impossible for science to be objective in some magisterial, uniform, old-fashioned Newtonian way. Do you think we should forget about notions of objectivity altogether and try and develop a new methodology of science that would incorporate human experience? How can we operate with science not being objective? How can we do to make it fair, if not objective?
That's a really good question, because to say that science is not objective is not the same thing as saying that any old thing counts as science. Science has canons. That is to say, we have a certain logic, for example, which demands that 1 + 1 = 2, and any scientist who says, well, I'm going to tell you about the world, and the basis of my telling you about the world is my understanding that 1 + 1 = 3, is something we want to reject. In the same sense, anyone who says that the moon is made of green cheese is simply saying that something that isn't true. And just because it seems to them that the moon might be made of green cheese, that doesn't make it science either. So although science is not objective in a social sense and one we can talk about, there are certain rules about a material world and the way you deal with that material world. There are certain rules of logic which work for us when we manipulate the material world. And logic is, after all, only made up by people, but these rules turn out to work for us. That science must follow. And in that sense, we must demand that science be so-called objective. It's got to follow the rules of logic which make the world work for us. It's got to accept certain material relations in the world which are the same under all political systems and under all ideologies. So we can't simply call for a kind of fuzzy-minded view of the world.
Objectivity.
But what we can do,
you know, we talk a great deal about can journalists, can broadcasters be objective? And our answer is that what we try to do is share the process as much as possible. How did we do it? Where did we get the information from? What did we do with it? What did we do next? And things of that kind. Is that a method which works in science?
Well, let me speak first about broadcasters and say if broadcasters really want to be objective about science, they need to tell people more than they're telling them. They need to tell them not only what the methods of science are and what the physical or commercial product of science is, they need to tell them the objective facts about where that science came from. They ought to tell their listeners or their readers why scientists are really doing this particular bit of science, who's paying for it, who will benefit from it, where the ideas come from, and so on. And when they do that, that's part of their task as objective observers of the social scene. For scientists, part of their objectivity has got to be the self-consciousness of where their ideas come from, of who's paying for it, of who will benefit. For example, in the case of hybrid corn, if scientists would stop saying that hybrid corn is the way to increase corn yields and recognize that hybrid corn is a very important commercial product from which people make a lot of money, and that the reason we've developed hybrid corn is because there's been a lot of pressure on science to produce this method of making money, that would be part of scientific objectivity. Scientific objectivity does not include only the objectivity of test tubes and computers. It includes objectivity in the sense of a broader view of science as a social product.
You encourage our listeners not to leave science to the experts. Given what you see as the ideological nature of science, what can we do to ensure that science is at least socially responsible?
Well, I hate to give a flip answer to that question, but I think ultimately the only answer is to make a social revolution. The problem is one of power. To make science socially responsible means to deprive a small group who are in the know of the power they have to decide in which direction science will go and what you and I, or perhaps not you and I because we're both PhDs, but what other people will learn about science. The real issue is that a social institution can only respond to general social demands when there is some power on the part of people in general to control what those institutions do.
Science is already socially responsible to some people, namely to an elite of some kind, a power elite. And the problem is not science's responsibility, but exactly to whom should science be reporting?
That's precisely the point, Lister. You've put it exactly right. Of course science is socially responsible because, after all, somebody's paying the bills. Somebody is creating the university. Somebody's sitting on the boards of trustees. Somebody's sitting there in the National Research Council of Canada giving away money. And scientists are responsible to those people. So, of course, I assume the question you were really asking me was, how do we make science answer, because responsible means literally answerable to, how do we stop making science answerable to those people and make it answerable to everybody else? And my answer to that is only when the mass of people can succeed in acquiring real political power. The answer for science is not different from the answer for any other aspect of society. You cannot have a science that is responsible to the majority, the vast majority of people, if you don't have other social institutions that are responsible, answerable. And it has simply turned out that the two models that have existed in the world up to the present time, namely the so-called democratic model in which people go to the polling booth and they vote for people. That's one model. The other is in which you have a leading party which is supposed to stand for the interests of everybody else and do what's good for them. Neither of those models has succeeded so far in providing to most people the power to control social institutions for their own welfare.
That was Dr. Richard Lewontin speaking on Biology as Ideology. This is the first of a series of lectures on that subject he gave in 1990. We'll be playing more of them on the program.